I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I, that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we were joined by one legend of Irish cycling last week. We've got another one this week, Orla Shinawee.
Hello, Richard. That was a terribly flattering introduction.
I think it's accurate, though, Orla. I think you've earned that description now. Orla of Sky Sports joining us this week as our special guest. Hopefully, Orla will be a semi-regular over the winter, although it depends how she gets on today, really. Bit of a trial. Before we crack on, we should ask Lionel, where are we, Lionel?
We are in Orla's back garden.
Near France.
Very near France, yeah. See, it's a long way from home for
it
me.
It really
that's
isn't.
For sure.
It really isn't. We're just outside London, but you boys get nosebleeds coming this far, so.
I brought my passport just in case. Right, we've got a lot to talk about. The Vuelta is reaching its climax. We've just watched today's 16th stage, and it was a thrilling one that sets it up very nicely for the last few stages. We'll be talking about the Tour of Britain as well. Orla's just back from the Tour of Britain, where you did an interview with Bradley Wiggins and picked up other bits and pieces of gossip. But Lionel, first, the weekly roundup. What's been happening in the world of cycling this week?
Well, apart from the Vuelta and the Tour of Britain, the Tour of Alberta's been going on. There's been a bit of a shambles there overnight. Last night's stage, the riders were sent off course. Anyone watch that, they'll have seen that it all degenerated into... I should point out, I didn't actually watch this. I've just done my research very well. And also, a bit of transfer news, or a bit of team news, really. The Europe Car team, Jean-René Bernadeau's Europe Car team, looks like it's going to be saved. Sponsor apparently lined up, and rumours that Sylvain Chavanel, or not even rumours, pretty strong indications that Sylvain Chavanel will return to the Vendée-based team where he spent the early part of his career. So sort of career turns full circle for Sylvain Chavanel.
And maybe when we talk about the Tour of Britain, we can talk a bit about Mark Cavendish. We haven't got Daniel Freeb here to do the normal sort of transfer speculation, but a few little rumours about what Mark Cavendish is going to be doing, not least because Bradley Wiggins told you, Orla, that Cavendish is definitely moving. If there are a few little noises in the background, by the way, we should explain that that is the youngest member of the podcast team, Eve Shinawee, who is coming up for 1 year old.
That's right, yeah. She's nearly 11 months now.
She's been on the podcast before, but she's maybe a little bit more vocal this time. We hope not.
Yeah, pipe down there, Eve, love.
Okay, listen, we've just watched the 16th stage of the Vuelta. Tuesday is a rest day. Wednesday, there's a time trial. And it's funny, isn't it? Because we talk about the Vuelta as the hilliest of the Grand Tours, as the one that favours the climbers. But we're actually looking at a scenario now where a big time trialist, Tom Dumoulin, or somebody that we thought of as a time trialist, might be in pole position. He's fourth overall at 151. And he might have just done enough in these mountain stages to leave himself within striking distance of the red jersey.
Well, he is within striking distance of the red jersey. Quite a few of the sports directors at the Vuelta have been saying that the likes of Joaquim Rodriguez and Fabio Aru would need 3 minutes going into Wednesday's time trial, and they don't have anything like that. 151. If Tom Dumoulin time trials as well as we think he can, or as well as we think he will, he may well be in the red jersey going into the final four stages of the race. They're not straightforward, the final four stages. There's a quite a difficult mountain stage on Saturday, but the way he's been climbing, the other climbers, the purer climbers, if you like, the likes of Aru, Rodriguez, who are obviously a lot more explosive, but they're not making that explosivity count, particularly on today's final stage. The last climb was incredibly difficult. It was the one where you would have expected Dumoulin to have real difficulty. But he dug, I imagine, very deep and limited his losses to 30 seconds-ish.
Rodriguez has looked really good the last couple of stages. He won Sunday's stage. He took the red jersey in Monday's stage. He seems to have been getting better. He was my tip going into the race. I will remind you that I thought that he was going to ride a good Vuelta. Could finally perhaps win a Grand Tour, perhaps. I mean, he's also somebody who's there in contention now. But as you say, Lionel, you would fancy Dumoulin to claim back 151 on Rodriguez.
You would, and it's sort of history repeating itself, isn't it? Because Rodriguez looked like he was going to win the Giro and then lost out to another big, a very sort of rangy rider, Ryder Heisdahl. Was that 2012 Giro? Really, Rodriguez climbed well enough in that Giro to win the race, lost it in the time trial. Very similar potential outcome here, but of course the difference is that there are still these four stages afterwards. So Dumoulin, if he does take the red jersey, it doesn't mean that he's won the Vuelta. There's still quite a lot to do. And the because of the types of riders that Aru and Rodriguez in particular are, there's always a chance that if they really gear up on the final mountains, knowing that they've got nothing else... Sorry, unfortunate phrase there, gearing up. If they really sort of, if they really apply themselves to attacking, lifting the pace, making it very irregular for Dumoulin, who clearly rides in quite a sort of Bradley Wiggins style. He's got high cadence, but it's quite a measured, fast pace rather than, you know, he doesn't particularly look comfortable when it's jerking up and down the pace. So there's still a lot of race to go. But what has been fantastic, I think we all agreed about this, was that the Vuelta, as you say, Rich, looking at it on paper with all these huge mountain stages, particularly supposedly the hardest Grand Tour mountain stage ever, which turned into a bit of a damp squib, really, didn't it? It was a little bit too hard for real explosive fireworks. But the thing that's been so refreshing about it is that it's offered riders of such different physical capabilities as Aru and Rodriguez on one side and Dumoulin the chance to compete, and they're looking to make their gains in very different parts of the race. So it's been fascinating, and still, you know, best part of a week to go.
I think it's really exciting to see Dumoulin so close up there and the possibility of taking the Vuelta a España. I think we've spoken before about it kind of suffers as a race in a way from an image problem whereby it's seen as being a pure climber's race, and given that that it comes where it does in the season as well, I think that those who aren't maybe hardcore cycling aficionados don't necessarily tend to tune in. Unless mountains really are your thing, then you've got 3 weeks of that really, and not an awful lot else. So to be able to have a different kind of rider up there, and then the possibility of the organisers, as they did this year in fact, and including the time trials and doing that primarily for the benefit of Chris Froome, we understand, but then creating a course that's a little bit more rounded and a little bit more, I think, interesting to the casual bystander is a great thing. And we've spoken a little bit about the popularity or otherwise of the Vuelta. I don't know if we're going to discuss it, and we've all got different opinions on that, but I think that's something that can only be good in terms of bringing in the spectators and new viewers to it.
In that sense, I mean, I've often been critical of long time trials in Grand Tours because they just tend to enable one rider to deliver the hammer blow that then basically either neutralizes the race in a lead up to the time trial because everybody everybody's basically waiting for it, or it puts the race, as it did in 2012, puts the race pretty much beyond anybody else. Bradley Wiggins was so strong in that time trial in, I think, Besançon, was it? Mm-hmm. That, you know, he'd already been very good on the previous mountain stage, but basically that put the race beyond everyone else. Whereas here, it's sort of been there as not necessarily the decisive part of the race, but it's something that all of the other riders have been conscious of. But Dumoulin has just been clinging on to the hope that if he can get to that time trial still within, it's giving him so much to fight for. And that is what's made it such a fascinating race so far.
It's been fascinating, hasn't it? Because they talk about the benefits of being in the leader's jersey and how riders in the leader's jersey ride out their skin. And it's been a sort of reverse Grand Tour, because the big time trial does usually come a week into the race. This one comes a few days from the finish. And I guess for a lot of for the climbers, they don't really know how much time they need on Dumoulin. So it's made it really intriguing. It hasn't been that Dumoulin's built this lead and then is hanging on, and the riders he's up against can kind of gauge their efforts according to, you know, chipping away at his lead. They're chipping away at a lead that doesn't exist. It's a virtual lead that he has by virtue of this time trial. It's been really fascinating to watch.
And the other point that you made, Richard, really interesting, I hadn't really thought of it until you said it while we were watching the stage, is that the dynamic is interesting because it isn't just Aru against Dumoulin or Rodriguez against Dumoulin. It's Aru and Rodriguez on the one side and Dumoulin on the other. And you could say, well, why don't Aru and Rodriguez go all out? It's because they're also worried about each other. So if Aru goes too far into the red, he runs the risk of, okay, he might gain enough time on Dumoulin, but fall foul of a counter-attack from Rodriguez. So you've got that. That's why it's so finely balanced. It isn't just about Dumoulin's time-trialling ability frightening the climbers. It's that the climbers have got to watch each other as well as work out whether Dumoulin's got enough time. And the other thing that to bear in mind is in the time trial, it's always possible that Dumoulin won't do the ride we're expecting because of how deep he's had to go in the mountains. So usually the time trial stages of the Grand Tours tend to be a good opportunity for an afternoon nap in the Bernie household. And then I wake up, wipe the drool from my face and rewind the television to look at the results. That's perhaps a little bit too much of a revelation of what goes on. I'm a very professional cycling journalist, honestly. But this time it will be one of those ones where I just hope they really get the TV coverage of it right so we get an accurate idea of who is doing what on the road, because they're so close on the GC, they're all going to be on the road together within, you know, a couple of K of each other. Having those time gaps is going to really make or break the sort of viewing experience. So
that information is going to be critical, isn't it, to the experience of watching it. And then you've got Dumoulin going ahead of Rodriguez, obviously, which is going to, you know, and the other guys. I mean, it's an interesting point about the climbers watching these stages, which have been very hard, steep climbs. They neutralise the race in a way because it's incredibly hard to judge your effort on these climbs. And, you know, Aru, Rodriguez, Quintana, Nairo Quintana, who for most people was a favourite going to the race, but he's now 3 minutes back. He's not going to win the race. He's been ill, apparently. And I think they've all been a bit scared of him, you know. I think that's been a factor as well. But it's very hard for all these guys. And only the last couple of days we've seen Rodriguez really let rip. But the difficulty for them has been, as you say, Lionel, just knowing what, just how much you can expend.
And that's the problem as well. Whenever you have climbs, so many climbs that are so difficult, or at least you're being told that they're so difficult, it encourages defensive riding, really, because you're wanting to save yourself for that next climb, for that next climb, and you don't want to blow up and have nothing in reserve for the next day. And that's not the kind of racing that anyone wants to see. I'm sure for the riders themselves, it's not necessarily how you want to win any Grand Tour. And I like that spice of a time trial at this stage in the race that's not, as you say, so long that you need to be borrowing one of Eve's bibs on the sofa. Because it does mean that it's enough to inject a little bit of uncertainty, a little bit of something extra into the mix without it being decisive. And I don't think anybody really wants to see a Grand Tour with one decisive stage, unless it turns out to be that in an unexpected way, as we all love. But I don't really like it whenever you see a Grand Tour route unveiled and you think, oh, that's where it's going to be decided. I much prefer to see a route that leaves everything up in the air a little bit, because that means that the riders then are sort of gauging from each other as well as to how they're going to be racing it. I think having a time trial at this stage is good, and I don't like having too many of the climbs that encourage defensive racing too much together.
Great professionalism from Orla there, just to carry on with her train of thought while her baby is screaming beneath her feet. Very impressive.
Professionalism or bad mothering.
Yeah, I was going to say, neglect or no.
She's happy now.
Happy enough now. I was going to say the hardest Grand Tour stage ever, which is how it was dubbed by some, did basically turn out into that kind of defensive battle, because I suspect nobody really knew just how hard those final climbs were going to be. And there was an awful lot of climbing that day. I mean, they went straight up right from the start. Chris Froome, of course, crashed early on a kind of a fairly benign looking but fast downhill right-hand sweeping bend, smashed his foot on a wooden sort of Arnco barrier, rode the rest of the stage, lost about 8 minutes, found out later at hospital that he fractured his foot. You know, that was a pretty amazing ride to get through that stage in so much pain. When he got off the bike, he was hobbling, couldn't really put any weight on his foot. But that stage didn't really tell us a great deal. It just kept everybody bunched together. But it was Dumoulin's performance that was so extraordinary that day. And I think that was the moment when we thought, this guy has really got a chance to win it. But the 16th stage, which we've just watched, was won by Frank Schleck. And although there was defensive riding, because the time gap was so big, 10 minutes between the Schleck group and the favourites, or if you want to look at it another way, Frank Schleck was riding in 2006 and the group of favourites were riding in 2015. There was enough to watch, enough intrigue. The race at the head of the race was entertaining. And also, it gave you a 10-minute head start. you got one opportunity to see exactly what the road was like 10 minutes ahead of when the favourites were coming. So in that sense, you saw Frank Schleck, how far over the front of the bike he was, how much that gradient bit. And I know everybody was thinking, you know, is this 25 or 30%? Very difficult to see on the TV the slope of the road, but you can tell from the body shape of the riders just how steep that was. That was an absolutely brutal incline. And then you could work out who was going to do what, or you could guess who was going to do what on which bit of road. And it didn't surprise me that Rodriguez went on the second from last part that was extremely steep, and Aru just waited, and he went hard on the last really steep bit just to close that gap. So that was very smart riding by Aru, who we did think at one point looked in a little bit of difficulty. Dumoulin just rode, you know, in a bubble. And we talked to Sean Kelly a bit about this last week over lunch, about how hard it is to just stop thinking about the race that's going on around you, worrying about the time that you might be losing to riders who are going away from you, and just stick in your own zone. He could very easily have pushed it too hard at the wrong point, gone into the red, and could have lost a minute in, you know, 800, 900 metres, but didn't, limited it, and is in with a great shout.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast in association with British Eurosport.
Thank you to British Eurosport, the home of cycling, who sponsor the cycling podcast. You can watch the Tour of Britain live with Rob Hatch and Matt Stevens, and of course the Vuelta a España is also live on British Eurosport. That's with Carlton Kirby and Sean Kelly, friend of the podcast, Sean Kelly. Now, Lionel, on the eve of the Tour of Britain, you went off for a little jolly, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Well, we all got invited, Richard, but you and Daniel couldn't make it. Daniel is doing his own tour of Berlin at the moment.
I was busy.
Yeah, and you were busy?
I'm very busy.
Yeah.
In demand.
Yeah. Well, I took a day out of my busy schedule to go down to the New Forest for the Garmin Rideout. Garmin have been doing this for quite a few years now. Obviously to promote their products to the cycling industry. They get the Cannondale Garmin team over, the Madison Genesis team were also there to ride a roughly 50-mile route through very pleasant New Forest countryside. And I was invited down there and rolled out in a group which contained one Cannondale Garmin rider. Didn't really catch who it was because he was quite a bit ahead of me and I did try and catch him up, but they were pressing on a bit. So we decided to let them go. But before the ride, I bumped into Charlie Wagelius, the sports director of the Cannondale Garmin team. And because we were there surrounded by Garmins, which are the handlebar computers that tell you all, you know, how fast you're going, what gradient you're riding up, how much power you're putting through the pedals, all that kind of thing. We had a bit of a reminisce about the old days of the handlebar computers, and we remembered the very first ones that we both had, the Avocet 30. And I'll post a picture of my Avocet 30 on the Cycling Podcast Twitter feed if I remember.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So, Charlie, we're both of a certain age. I think I'm a bit older than you, but we...
Certain age, that's a very polite way of putting it.
Yeah, I think, well, my best days are certainly behind me.
I think you've still got
some years left. Yeah. But we remember when the first cycling computers came along. We were just talking a few minutes ago about the Avocet 30, which was the first cycling computer that I had. I believe you had one as well, is that right?
Yeah, I did. I had an Avocet 30. It was lime green, which fits quite well with nowadays Cannondale colours. But I was very fond of it.
And the thing about the Avocet 30 was it basically gave you, as a young cyclist as you were at the time, a way to measure your rides, work out your average speed. But really, when you think back to those early cycling computers, and we're talking the late 80s, perhaps early 90s here, they probably had the sort of capacity of a Casio calculator, really, didn't they?
Yeah, they were incredibly basic. And there was wires and things that would, you know, get caught up in your tyres and your wheels and things. And I can remember that, I think in those days, it was the sign of a really good mechanic that would show a real attention to detail, you know, and send the wire along the fork and up the brake housing in a really sort of unobtrusive way. So I think there was quite an art to that that's been lost.
Were you like me? You'd look in the cycling magazines and, like you say, if you could tape the cable really in a straight line up the forks and then wrap it round in a spiral round the brake cable and then up so it was hidden. Yeah. That was basically, like you say, that was the mark of a, you know, an amateur professional, if you like.
Yeah, I think alongside, you know, efficient and well-done bar taping, that was a really good sign of attention to detail in those days.
There's quite a bamboozling array of features now that, that you can have. Is there a danger that, you know, there's almost too much information available? Do you have to kind of monitor how the riders use this information? Is there a lot of guidance from the team when it comes to, you know, getting the best out of the equipment they've got?
Honestly, I think this is something that sports at this level is still exploring and still at quite an early stage because, you know, only a few years ago, you know, having power data available on every bike for every rider wasn't a possibility. You know, only a few years ago, these were things that riders had to buy on their own budget and not every rider had them. So I think that cycling trainers and the riders are still in a phase at the moment where they're kind of enjoying collecting massive amounts of data. And the way I see it going soon is that people are going to have to work out more what to do with all that data, because it's one thing collecting it and it's another thing having, you know, data that you can actually take action on. So I think at the moment cycling in general is a little bit like a kid with a new toy. We're still playing with it and we're still working out what to do with it, and, you know, what soon I think we need to start to work out what we need to set aside, because you can't bury yourself in the data.
Sure. And do you think, in terms of how that data is used, the teams and the riders that gain that next little jump, that next little edge in performance, will be the ones that use the data smartest and discover a way to use that data? Because at the moment, like you say, you know, the perception is that it's used just in terms of conditioning and getting ready for a particular objective, but there must be much more to it than that.
Yeah, I think, you know, on the one hand, there's probably more that we could do with it, but I think often, you know, less is more also. So the key is going to be working out, you know, what's the pertinent information in all this, really.
And lastly, just on today's ride, the Tour of Britain team are here riding with a lot of members of the public, invited guests, people who are connected to various sponsors that are part of the Garmin setup and the Garmin ride out. What's a day like this like for your riders? I mean, it's kind of a, for them, a 50-mile sort of easy-ish day, a couple of days out from the Tour of Britain, probably not very different from what they would be doing anyway.
I think, you know, for these guys, contact with everyday cyclists is a really refreshing thing for them. I think compared to most top sports, they have more contact with the public than they usually do, but events like this are nice for them because, you know, I mean, they come off the bus on a race day and they meet members of the public, but they've really got things on their mind, and a day like today, they can really just spend time with people without, you know, having to go to sign on and go and ride a stage of the Tour de France a few minutes later. So I think it's nice for the people to meet them in a kind of stress-free environment and, you know, to talk to them when they're on their bikes and so on. And, you know, every time they come to these things, you know, the riders come away and they really enjoy it, because at the end of the day, they're just cyclists like everybody else. They just happen to go faster than most people. So for them to spend a day with fans just, you know, in a sort of stress-free environment, it's really good fun.
You say stress-free for the riders, less so for me. I'm riding. There's been a couple of high-profile incidents with motorcyclists knocking off riders in the Vuelta in the last week. I really don't want to find myself at the centre of some massive story, big storm, idiot brings down defending Tour champion. So I'm going to steer away from Dylan van Baarle, keep my distance, a good safe 3 or 4 metres, give myself a bit of braking space around the riders.
Yeah, I think the best thing to do would be to just remember back to when you did your first club run. And remember the rules that you were given then, you know, about holding your line and keeping your fingers on the brakes and stuff. But I'm sure you'll do fine.
And getting dropped after 8 miles.
Yeah. Did you get pushed home? Because I did from my first club run. So
I've got a funny feeling my dad may have come and picked me up. But
I'll give you a Mars bar. So if you get in trouble, that'll get you home.
Thanks, Charlie.
No worries.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So that was Charlie Regalius of the Cannondale Garmin team. I was talking to him at the start of the Garmin ride out. He didn't actually ride the event, but I did. I took my new bike down to the New Forest. It's got the Shimano Di2 electric gears.
You just a lot of names have come. Are we getting sponsored by any of these people?
No, I purchased this bike with my own actual money.
About the Di2 anyway, so I think it's fair enough to drop that in. Lots of people asking me. I have no idea what they're talking about, but
I'm just applying a bit of business sense here. Lionel,
maybe we should appealing for sponsorship. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, we've got news on that, Orla. That'll be coming next week. We have a new sponsor. We have a sponsor for the winter months. That'll keep you in podcasting for the winter. Very exciting, very interesting, very innovative partnership we're carving out with a company, and we will announce that next week.
Potentially humiliating partnership for the pair of us, Richard. More will be revealed next week. But yeah, Shimano Di2, it's basically an electronic gear system. For those who are unaware, instead of having cables connecting the gear shifters to the derailleurs and the front mech that change the gears, you just press a button and it's done by magic, I think. Just as an aside, if Shimano do want to chip in for my very expensive bike, then just get in touch and I'll give you my PayPal account details.
cyclingpodcast@outlook.com.
Anyway, so I turned up with my riding companion and friend who also runs a bike shop, and I'd gone off to the loo. I came back and he was sort of shaking his head in a comical fashion, and I thought he was winding me up, but he said, "Your Shimano Di2 battery has run down and is on the verge of conking out. You may not get round. You've got probably an hour's worth of changing left."
Does he not realise how rapid you are on the bike? 1 hour? Surely you could do it in half that time.
A 50-mile ride in half an hour. Yeah. You know, I'm not Vincenzo Nibali here. I didn't have a car to hold on to. Anyway, so I'd run my battery down, and everybody was laughing at me, quite rightly, because I am basically inept when it comes to anything mechanical, even just changing or charging a battery. But fortunately, the Madison Genesis team mechanic came to our rescue, lent us a charger, which we managed to hook up using some other bit of equipment to the cigarette lighter on my car. We charged the battery up enough, and I managed to get round the ride.
So you did actually have the assistance of a car after all.
I did.
Sticky cigarette lighter or something. Well, that's a nice segue into, I think, talking about the Tour of Britain, because that happened in Britain.
Yep.
And you were riding your bike in Britain, and the Tour of Britain is a bike race that happens in Britain.
Seamless.
Orla, you were up for the presentation in stage one.
Yes,
I was. What did you discover?
What did I discover? I guess the main thing was a rather amusing interview with Sir Bradley Wiggins, where he let the cat out of the bag on a number of issues. First of all, that he's hoping to ride the World Championships on the track with Mark Cavendish in London.
The Madison, indeed.
And that he seemed to have confirmed to me as well what we all suspected to be the case, and that Mark Cavendish is preparing to leave Etics Quickstep at the end of this season. So, he gave me those little tidbits in a live interview, and I have to say, it was classic vintage Wiggins on show that day. That was after stage one, where Team Wiggins had a fourth place finish with Owen Dool, and he was just deliriously happy by the looks of things.
I think delirious is the word. It's demob happy, really. And I mean, it's funny, he rode pretty well. I think he led out Owen Dool, who was fourth on the stage. A very good performance by him. And he made an interesting point, I thought, that, you know, in that team that he's in now, Team Wiggins, they were cock-a-hoop at that. Whereas at Team Sky, that would have been a disappointment. And maybe he just enjoys, it's a sort of liberating feeling being part of a team where they can celebrate minor successes like that.
I think very much so. It's like an unbridled Brad these days. I think the fact that his name is on the team for a start, he knows he's his own boss, really. He doesn't have to follow anyone else's orders, which was always a big problem he had at Team Sky. Following the discipline and dancing to someone else's tune, I think he is relishing this perhaps self-created image of the team being a gang of misfits,
He loves the idea of himself as an outsider, doesn't
he?
This is the great Bradley Wiggins paradox. You know, the knight of the realm, Britain's first Tour de France winner, multiple Olympic gold medal winner. He loves the idea of himself as an outsider. Discuss.
Well, he does, but it's a kind of conventional conformist idea of being an outsider, isn't it? I think there's a sense that he's always wanted to belong, but then once he belongs, he wants to be completely apart from things again. You know, he is the ultimate kid who's too cool for school. And that goes through everything. The choice of the team that's in his image is in his image, isn't it? It's a sort of, we've talked about the decision to sort of appropriate carefully selected segments of British cycling's heritage and turning them into kind of brand Brad, if you like. It's not necessarily a criticism, but it's not as kind of carefree and kind of you know,
or as original
as perhaps he thinks or people think it is. But having said that, you know, he has created an identity. Whether you particularly like that identity or not, it is very striking. And of course, they rode the first stage of the Tour of Britain in Tom Simpson celebratory jerseys, or basically celebrating 50 years since Tom Simpson won the World Championships. Again, that's by choosing to commemorate or celebrate Tom Simpson, that divides people as well. There's not even, you know, you can't gain consensus on that because of the fact, you know, Tom Simpson died and drugs were involved and all the rest of that. So there's, as you say, there is a complete paradox whenever you start thinking and, you know, if you concentrate on Bradley Wiggins too long, your eyes start to cross over because you just can't work out this mass of contradictions.
I think the thing with Simpson, and he's got a well-documented... I think adoration of the legend of Tom Simpson, but that appropriation of him and his history and his legend on the first stage of the Tour of Britain, okay, it was the anniversary was timely, but I think it's quite a deliberate way for him to hark back to the pre-golden days of British cycling and pre-Team Sky and say that the foundations of his team and the foundations of his success are... more rooted in the deeper culture of British cycling. And yes, we've had this new shiny behemoth coming along ever since. And he likes to say, you know, like whenever I was waiting for him to do the interview, it really struck me. I'd just been on board the Team Sky bus and, you know, the Death Star and how fantastically well equipped that was. And I think he really loved being back in a basic camper van and going back to the days when that was was elegant, luxurious form of transport for any British cyclist. And he likes to say that he came before all of that, even if it's just in spirit.
I think the word you're looking for is authenticity. That's what he's looking for. He's looking for authenticity. I mean, as you say, Lionel, when you zoom in on all these different aspects, these facets of Bradley Wiggins' character, but I'm a bit reminded, you know, it started, I suppose, a few years ago when he adopted the Paul Weller look. You know, sometimes, I'm sure you're the same, we're of a certain vintage where we go to concerts by, you know, pop musicians of the 80s and so on. Morrissey, I'm going to see Morrissey in a couple of weeks. Been to a few Morrissey concerts, and you go to a Morrissey concert and you see all these guys who still think they look like Morrissey, who've got the quiff and the sideburns. They're in their 40s and they all think they're being authentic and they all think they're being very original. And the irony is, of course, they're surrounded by other lookalikes, and it's kind of... You know, it's kind of strange.
Rebel, really, isn't
conformist
it?
Rebel, brilliant. That could be a T-shirt.
For the conformist rebels amongst you, yeah.
But he's not the first to, you know. I mean, cycling is a vehicle to promote brands, and you know, I'm sure the people who make the jersey were delighted to be associated with Tom Simpson's World Championship win. I mean, it's a victory of an era. It's something that, you know, when Mark Cavendish won the Worlds, it was a real moment because you realise just how long ago it was since Great Britain had its only other previous world champion. But, you know, they're not the only people to sort of get a dispensation to wear a crazy jersey or a different jersey. I mean, I remember being at the Tour in 1999 and Mario Cipollini and his Seiko team were, they wanted to start, or they did start in a kind of white and gold strip to commemorate, I think, the birth of Caesar, was it? Something like that. And Mario Cipollini
not
came
not enough
in.
Of that. There's not enough of that.
Mario Cipollini came in on a sort of, you know, almost dressed as Caesar with a big chariot of some description. Now,
there really isn't enough of that.
I'm pretty sure I remember that correctly.
You do remember that correctly. I was going to just say, finally on Wiggins, because this was supposed to be discussed about the Tour of Britain. Yeah. But, you know, Lorna's interview is very, it's worth watching. It's very entertaining. Mm-hmm. And he does look very relaxed and happy. But, of course, the ultimate irony is that he made some pointed remarks about Brailsford. He did a little impression of Dave Brailsford and Team Sky. And, you know, sort of distancing himself from Team Sky, the team without whom he would not have won
absolutely,
the Tour de France. You know, he owes it all to Team Sky.
And also, it's quite funny because he does portray himself as being this rebel and he doesn't need any of the corporate side of things, and he talked about the dictatorship of Team Sky, but he was very careful in that interview, and it was live. He was careful a number of times to correct himself when he said Sky, correct himself to say Team Sky, because of course Sky still sponsor his current team, so he was very careful not to annoy his current sponsor. So for all the talk of, or all the bravado I guess of being his own man and riding his own race and beating his own drum and whatnot. Sky are still paying for the drum, aren't they?
Sky, is that Orla? Sky. God, this is the product placement episode.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? If Sky want to send us any money, then Richard, you made the point
there. I'm nappies to buy, boys. What can I say?
You say about this was supposed to be a Tour of Britain segment, but in a way, that's what is so fascinating about the Tour of Britain, because when Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins are there, they stand above it head and shoulders, don't they? And once the racing got underway, we see, you know, I mean, I was quite interested to see Conor Dunn of the An Post team get in the break, an Irish lad, but brought up very close to me. I think I've actually raced against him at Hillingdon when he was about 17 or 18.
Who won?
Well, it was a bunch finish, Orla. I would have to look at the results to see whether Conor Dunn finished convincingly ahead of me.
As a 17-year-old.
Have you seen 17-year-olds these days? You wouldn't want to bump into them.
I think he was 8 at the time.
Yeah, he was. He's a very, very tall lad. Very strong, powerful. Got in the break. You know, Christian House in the break on the first day. You know, the kind of quintessential Tour of Britain was unfolding. And then we had a really interesting sprint finish between the sort of yesterday, today and tomorrow of bunch sprinting. And I'm not going to say who is who there, but Greipel, Cavendish and Elia Viviani.
I think you're right in saying that when we get sidetracked, I guess, talking about the Tour of Britain by talking about Bradley Wiggins and how Wiggins and Cavendish are the big draws. I was really interested this year to see much fewer people there than I've seen in the last couple of years, and it just struck me that we're at a bit of a crossroads at the moment in British cycling, whereby since I've been covering the sport, it's been growing exponentially, and you guys have been in it for quite a bit longer, but all I've seen really is growth year after year after year and popularity getting bigger and bigger. But when I look back to, it was 2013, the final stage of the Tour of Britain, we were in London on Westminster Bridge, and I remember Mark Cavendish coming out of the, as it was then, Omega Pharma Quickstep bus and getting up on the roof of the bus like he was a rock star. And the crowds went crazy for it. And there were two teenage girls, who managed to get his autograph. And they were screaming, "I'll never wash this pen." And they may know, I don't know why anyone would need to wash a pen, but they were acting as though it was, you know, One Direction or whatever the cool kids listen to these days, are not so cool. But it just felt so far from that this year. There were very few people at the team presentation for the sprint finish. Yeah, there were decent crowds, but not the crowds that we've seen in the last couple of years. And we have been spoiled in Britain, obviously, with the Olympics, with Tour de France champions, with the Grand Départ. And I just wonder what's going to happen next and where we're going to see it go next. Will it sort of tail off with the changing of the guard now? And I think the fact that, you know, the most recent British Tour de France winner, Chris Froome, doesn't ride the Tour of Britain, is it telling of the race? Is it telling of whether he feels he needs the British support? I'm not sure. But the fact that he's not there, I think, takes away from it slightly because he does race under a British flag. And I just thought, I wonder, are we at a crossroads right now? Will we see the same kinds of crowds in the next couple of years that we've seen in the last few years? I'm not so sure.
Well, this will be Wiggins' final Tour of Britain. Pretty sure of that. Mark Cavendish has, you know, he's ridden it pretty much every year. He's consistently there. We were going to talk about his likely location because he's definitely moving. Wiggins confirmed that to you, Orla, in your entertaining interview with him. We think he's going to MTN Quebec and taking a new sponsor with him, don't we?
Well, we do. We do think that. I mean, Brian Smith was saying very recently, that obviously they would love to take Cavendish, but it's all about the funding and whether or not Cavendish and his entourage could bring a sponsor and enough money with them effectively to cover the cost, because MTN itself is changing, pulling out. So the team, although its future is secure, it isn't a team that would be able to, secure Mark Cavendish at his current market value, even though perhaps that market value has dipped a bit. Although he had one Tour de France stage win, he's certainly not commanding the same sort of salary, or shouldn't really, if you're looking at the market, shouldn't really be in the same league as he was when he was negotiating that contract with Amica Pharma Quickstep, as it was. But it's interesting, Cavendish, I saw some quotes from him talking about why he does a Tour of Britain, because it's a hard race, there's sprint finishes, opportunities for him, and it's a good sort of preparation for the World Championships, and we think that he will be one of the outsiders for the course in Richmond. We think that sprinters will feature, but perhaps wouldn't be a pure sprinter's course, but he'll certainly be in with a shout if the race pans out the right way. And we've seen in the last few years the Tour of Britain being a perfect warm-up for the World Championships for a number of reasons. It's very rolling. There's stiff, hard climbs, but not the long mountains. So it's the ideal type of racing. Quite heavy roads. So it's a real good workout. And but he was saying that the Vuelta's gone too far the other way. 11 mountaintop finishes, not enough opportunities for the sprinters. But I've been doing a bit of research on World Tour races and how they are actually won. And the great majority, or not the great majority, but around 35 or 40% of World Tour races end in what you would term a bunch sprint. So, 40 plus riders. So there's plenty of opportunities for sprinters.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Okay, we're back. We're a bit distracted. This won't mean anything to most of you listening, but Orla is periscoping. And that will live on the Tinternet for 24 hours and then vanish.
Yeah. So it's only 24 hours only. Which is quite good, I think, because if you do a rubbish periscope, then it goes. So it's quite nice.
That's really good. So a few people are maybe watching on that. It won't, as I say, it won't mean anything to most of you, but it's something we might experiment with again. Lionel doesn't look keen on that idea.
We're at the cutting edge of technology, Richard, and we will embrace anything that helps connect with our considerable audience.
Absolutely. Just returning a little bit to the Tour of Britain, and Cavendish's possible move to MTN Quebec, and I think an announcement will be forthcoming in between the end of the Tour of Britain and the World Championships, having spoken to his manager Simon Bailiff on Friday. One of the things that people loved at the Tour de France, I think, was the African team. Now they're losing their South African climber, who's been riding a very good Vuelta, Louis Menkes, to Lamprey. Will that African identity be diluted somewhat if Cavendish arrives?
I think it would necessarily, fundamentally by virtue of the fact that its biggest named rider isn't African. I think you associate an awful lot of the team with the biggest rider as well as the origin of where the team is actually from. I mean, I think that's where Team Sky's national identity has come from so strongly, the fact that Bradley Wiggins and Chris Froome both race under the British flag. I don't know, but that's just my opinion on it.
But they'll still have African riders, won't they? I mean, Team Sky, Elia Viviani's won a stage of the Tour of Britain. Mikel Nieve is now the best placed rider in the Vuelta. They're an international team. And I think the idea of, even like Etix Quickstep, I mean, are they any less Belgian because Mark Cavendish has been one of their team leaders for the last few years?
No, and I think they've managed to do that very well, and I don't know why exactly. I can't put my finger on it, but I think their national identity is incredibly strong. So yeah, I could be wrong with MTN Quebec, but I think they've managed that strength of image because they haven't necessarily had a big international star on their books, and that might change. However, from speaking to Brian Smith at the Tour of Britain, the ethos of the team is very much still about the fundraising and the charity work for Africa and buying the bikes for the African kids. So he'll certainly be keen to make sure that that's still a part of it. So as long as they keep that charity focus at the forefront of what they do, then they should be able to keep it, I guess.
It's all a balance, isn't it? When a team is created for whatever reason, whether it's just to sell products or, in the case of MTM Quebec, to have a sort of much broader and charity-based, not just the charity aspect of it, but also developing African cycling. Mm. There has to be a sort of pragmatic balance struck. If they stay as they are, they will just remain a small team, and they will always have their, you know, the next Louis Menkes will just be picked off after 1 year or 2 years. What they need to do is use the likes of Mark Cavendish to grow the profile, attract other funding. If they keep the sort of the African beating heart of the team strong, then they bring the profile of African cycling up with them. If they stay as they are, then they'll just be another continental level team which will inevitably wither on the vine and disappear.
We're assuming here that Cavendish is joining MTN Quebec. We don't know that for sure. It just seems to be the most likely candidate, because it is likely that wherever he goes he will take a sponsor with him and an entourage. Anything else from Tour of Britain? I'm off to the Tour of Britain this week, so I'm hoping to speak to one or two riders there, maybe see friend of the podcast Theo Gegenhart, who I spoke to on Friday ahead of the race. He rode extremely well last year, 15th overall, looking to build on that. And then he'll have a couple of outings for Team Sky as a stagiaire. Doesn't know yet what races he will ride.
Theo will be looking forward to racing on his home Scottish roads, won't he? You know, shortbread for dinner. And,
even though he's Irish.
Andy Fenn as well.
Yeah.
Two Scots will really, I imagine they'll both shine on the Scottish roads.
I think they've brought their tartan specifically, so just to feel at home.
Definitely can. I'll be up in Scotland, so I'll see both of them there. Theo will get back on the podcast at some point soon. I mentioned that he's a friend of the podcast. He is. Orla, you're a friend of the podcast as well. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Become a friend and gain access to 8 exclusive friends specials at the moment. We're adding a few more to those before the end of the year. So £5 for the year. That will gain you access to all our 2015 Friends specials. Anything else? What are we expecting from the Tour of Britain the last few days, Lionel? Who's going to win it?
Oh, that's impossible. The Tour of Britain is the hardest race of the year to call. I mean, we haven't had a breakaway yet that's put any time in between. You know, nobody's really ruled in or ruled out. I imagine it will be similar to last year, although the course isn't quite as dynamic. I think the Suffolk stage on the penultimate day, pretty benign. The day before that, I think, goes from Nottingham to from Stoke to Nottingham again. Perhaps not many opportunities there. So it's going to be decided in the Scotland and the Lake District stage. And I think that will set the pattern for the rest of the week. And it will be, well, I mean, you could...
I didn't hear you say who's going to win there.
Exactly. I mean, you could put all the names on a dartboard, blindfolded, and throw a dart, and you'd have as much chance of picking the winner of the tour.
That's how you normally do these things, is it not?
That's how I win money at betting, yeah.
Yeah, because Alex Dowsett was pointing out just how unpredictable a race it is and was reminding me how last year he was a couple of minutes behind and then he's in the leader's jersey the next day. So it is remarkable like that. But we were talking earlier about time trials and the benefits and disadvantages of them. What do we think about it not being a time trial in this year's Tour of Britain? Is that... does it make the race any the poorer or not?
I think it's generally a good thing.
I think in a race like the Tour of Britain it is, because that really, although it wasn't the case the most recent occasion, but often, you know, if you've got a time trial in the Tour of Britain, when it was in Knowsley Safari Park, that basically decided the race for Bradley Wiggins. That was a real design for him, so he could win the race. When it's been the little short circuit down in London, it's been pretty inconsequential anyway, hasn't it, really?
A little mountain time trial would be good. I remember the 1989 Tour of Britain began with a time trial up,
Stirling?
up in Dundee.
Dundee.
Actually, 1998 Pro Tour began with a hilly, well, climb up to Stirling Castle.
That's right.
Yeah. They're a bit different.
Yeah, maybe have like a mountain time trial on the Tumble in South Wales or something like that. That's an idea for Mick Bennett to chew over.
Mick, if you're listening, listen, we should wrap up or we're going to go over our allotted hour. As ever with you, Orla, we've had lots to talk about.
I thought you were going to blame me there for rambling. I didn't
I thought you rambled much.
Concise this time.
You were quite concise, yeah.
Can I abuse my position as a host of the cycling podcast to,
no.
to plug?
So that's all for...
Excellent.
Go on,
next week, Richard, I'm not sure if I'll be here for the podcast. I hope I will, if we're recording early in the week. But towards the end of next week, I'm cycling from Brighton to Paris with a colleague of ours, Jeremy Whittle and Pete Godding, for charity. And I'm trying to raise as much money as possible. I've never done one of these charity rides before, so it's a bit of a first for me. I've been training really hard for it, hoping to set a world record for Brighton to Paris.
I can attest to that. You've been fueling rather well in my living room earlier, stocking up on the sugar, the refined sugar.
Chocolate biscuits, yes, for lunch. So if you would like to sponsor me, I'm talking to Periscope as well, if you'd like to sponsor me on my ride to Paris, just check out my Twitter feed at Lionel Birnie, LionelBirnie, and I'll post a link on there that you can follow and donate as much as you want. £50, £100, £150.
But not before you've become a friend of the podcast for a measly £5.
Since everyone's having their say, can I just say hello to all my friends and family and anyone who might be listening, since we're all having a little chance to have a word? No,
that's most... I don't think you're going to be invited back on the basis of that. That's an abuse of your guest status.
Oh, wow.
Lionel's earned the right to engage in that rather embarrassing sort of plea for sponsorship for his bike ride. Well, you know, that's fine.
It's not for me.
No, it's for charity.
I'm doing a selfless act here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, it's very impressive. I wish you good luck with that. I wish you good luck with that. And that's all for this week. So thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Orla.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.